You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey, you. It is Mother's Day in the U.S. and Canada today, and so it seemed perfectly appropriate that this would be the episode that would be going up. It's going to surprise you, I think. It's a chat with this incredible, incredible human being named Anastasia Higginbotham. She has more than 20 years of experience doing justice work and being fiercely feminist in the most amazing ways. And she recently, with the help of Feminist Press, started publishing a series of children's books called Ordinary Terrible Things. These books are for kids who are really young, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. But in reading them for myself, I was hearing the words that I wish I would have heard every single day from the youngest of ages to understand my body, my edges, what I was allowed to say yes and no to. And also, there's something powerful about the way that Anastasia takes enormous topics like death, divorce, kids telling you you're gay before you even have an identity or a word for it yourself, racism, and allowing kids to be the center of that experience with their feelings and their confusion. It's like truly the kind of stuff that if all of us had an opportunity to have conversations like these and books like these from early, early ages, would completely change our sex negative culture and this patriarchal culture. And so I'm like so excited about this. I also want to remind you that Dylan and I have officially recorded our chat and it is so juicy. It will be coming out at the end of May. And if you want to get a super exclusive version of our chat, that will be going up for Patreon supporters at all levels. So from $1 up, folks over on Patreon are going to get an extended version of that chat, which, oh my gosh, you know, Dylan is amazing. So you can go to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show over there. And of course, every single dollar helps me to pay for website and technology and hosting of this show. And I appreciate it so, so, so much. There's also something really special at the end of this episode. So if you wait until the end of my chat with Anastasia, there's actually a little sneak peek of what's coming next week, because next week's episode, I think, is going to be very big and very important, and it's all about abortion. And I collected stories from a handful of people who were brave and decided it was okay for me to share their stories. And so one of those stories, it's a very intense story, is at the very end of this episode. And I will offer a few words about what's coming next week. And I really hope that you tune in. So here is a little bit about Anastasia. Anastasia Higginbotham is a writer and artist who created the children's book series Ordinary Terrible Things, published by the Feminist Press. The series includes Divorce is the Worst, Death is Stupid, and Tell Me About Sex, Grandma, which is what brought me to Anastasia. It's been embraced by children and adults for empowering and trusting kids as the authority on their own lives. Higginbotham makes the books in collage on brown grocery paper bag with clippings from magazines and catalogs, and bits of fabric and jewelry that have special meaning. Higginbotham's series is informed by more than 20 years as a speechwriter for New York City nonprofits that combat all kinds of injustice. For 10 years, Higginbotham taught full impact self-defense to kids and adults with Prepare Inc., which we do talk about today in this chat about why fighting actually helped her heal from things like rape. Coaching students ages 6 and up to breathe, talk, and fight their way through confrontation and attack scenarios. Her essays have appeared pretty much everywhere, like Huffington Post, Miss, Bitch, The Sun, and many other places that you can see on sexgetsreal.com. And she's featured in a series of anthologies. So here is my chat with Anastasia, specifically about Tell Me About Sex, Grandma. And then at the end, we'll talk about abortion. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Anastasia. I am ridiculously excited to have you here.
Thank you. I am ridiculously excited to be talking with you. This is really, really wonderful.
There's a lot of things that I love to roll around in with you today. You have such a rich history of feminist work and writing about sexuality and being just so involved. And right now, you're in the middle of creating this incredible series of kids' books for fairly young children called Yes. Ordinary Terrible Things. Yes. And a couple of the titles of the books are Death is Stupid, Divorce is the Worst, and Tell Me About Sex, Grandma, which is how I found you. And you've got some other books that are kind of coming up over the next couple of years around racism, gayness, and something called Ruined, You Ruined It, which I'm super curious about. And so I love that you're talking to kids about these really interesting, juicy, and often awkward and charged topics. Yeah. And so I'd love to start with just, when we're talking about divorce, death, racism, how does sex end up in there?
Well, sex ends up in there. I mean, it's not supposed to be there, right? It's supposed to be this beautiful thing, this organic thing. And yet it is there because of the way that our culture is. I mean, it's this thing that's everywhere. It's in all the songs, you know, in the supermarket. It's in the song that's playing overhead. It's on the advertisement for the movie and the bus that's going by. It's on the huge Victoria's Secret posters that we pass in the mall. And yet it's hidden too. It's this thing that adults are trying to hide it from kids, even though it's so blatantly something that we're kind of obsessed with. It's this thing that kids learn that is secret and saturated in it, into everything at the same time. So it must be powerful. Mm-hmm. And even it might be dangerous. And so a child is naturally going to be interested in what that's about. They're drawn to power. I mean, we all are. And so I think the power of it is really compelling, but the repressed way that we deal with it, or rather don't deal with it, especially in American culture, that's the only culture I know, I haven't lived anywhere else, is very confusing. And I think that those conflicting messages, contradictory ways we talk about it and don't talk about it, are giving kids a very mixed message. I also think that kids are growing up with all these stories about the prince and the princess falling in love, and the man and the woman, the mother and the father, and all of these heterosexual couplings, and this idea that sex has something to do, you know, has everything to do somehow with the baby that's getting made between those two people. And if you're a child who has already connected a little bit with your own desire and your own leanings and your own attraction and the comfort and pull that you feel towards someone of your same gender or your same sex, then those stories are oppressive. They become oppressive, and they give you a message that you don't fit already. And so there's that, those little baby desires that are just starting to come out are not going to come out as healthily, or they're not going to just burst out like they should be allowed to. And I think kids will tend to like close that down and pull that back. because they see that there's not really a place for it out there. And so that, I think, makes sex an ordinary, terrible thing. Mm-hmm. And then finally, if someone's messing with you, if you're being interfered with, if somebody's brought sexual energy or sexual attention or sexual activity into your life and you didn't ask for it, sex becomes a very confusing thing. And you don't even know what to call it yet. So I wanted it there in the ordinary, terrible thing, so we could dial the conversation back and start having it from this place of like, wait. It's not out there. It's in you already. Let's start there. Mm.
Yeah, one of the things that I read as I was kind of preparing for this was the line around trusting kids as the authority on their own lives, and that's really what your books do. And I think there's so much beauty and power in allowing kids to have their feelings validated, to have their questions, and for adults to even maybe be able to say, I don't know, but that's a really good question. And, you know, I'm like obsessed with emotional intelligence, and I've been doing lots of reading around it. And what I just keep finding is the ways that for most of my life, I have felt like my feelings weren't valid, that I wasn't allowed to have certain types of feelings, or that I was bad for having certain types of feelings. And so I think there's something so beautiful in these books where you're allowing kids to actually ask kind of awkward, kind of hard questions and to have big feelings around these things. And sex certainly is a place where I think we have so many feelings, but we try to pretend like we don't.
And it's hard to own it. And it's interesting to me that you have that experience and that you would be, I mean, so many of us, I think, are drawn to these titles, even though the titles are, I mean, there's, you know, stupid. You're not supposed to say stupid I mean, a lot of kids are not allowed to say stupid. And I put it on the cover because it's like, no, we have to give them permission, especially during a crisis, to say exactly what's going on for them and exactly what occurs to them to say without censoring it and trying to behave. Because, you know, as you know, feelings don't behave. And when you're all stirred up like that, it's the last thing you want to do is tell a kid, you know, that's not the right feeling, or don't lead with that, or don't tell me about it.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of people, if they had that experience when they were children, they don't know what to do when they're then the adult and the child is saying something that's just not, it's too big. It's too much.
You know, something that I find so interesting, and like as a sex educator, I run into this and feel very frustrated, but I know that I'm outside of the norm in a way because of all the things that I've worked on and been exposed to and learned, but it's this chronic denial by parents and administrators and legislators in accepting that like children do have sexual feelings, they have sexual identities, they have sexual desires, and the type of sexual desire or identity you have when you're 5, 6, 7 years old is not the same type of sexual identity you have when you're 25 years old, but there's kind of this application of adult sexual experiences onto young people and kind of denying that they have curiosity, denying that their teenager will be the one that has sex, denying that college students are going to get into very complicated situations with consent and alcohol. And so it becomes this like very dangerous conversation where we kind of move through our adolescent and childhood years. And all of a sudden we're expected to just know how to behave in adult situations when we haven't ever had those conversations.
No. And no validation from the adults that they went through it too.
Yes.
It's very bizarre. What age group do you teach sex ed to? Do you teach young children too? Or are you mostly with adolescent and older?
I'm mostly adults.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it boggles my mind that people don't, is it, do Are they more scared because they do remember what they felt when they were kids, or because they don't remember anymore? I mean, it's just to not want your child to develop sexually at their own pace, on their own terms, is in a way to not want your child to develop, to not, you don't want them to grow up.
Yeah.
And that's, that can do some real harm. And it's customary mm-hmm. to not want your daughter to start dating. And I get it in terms of what you're afraid of, but good God, to start having those conversations early so you don't have to be so scared. Let her know what she needs to know and let her tell you what she already knows so that you can see what you're working with mm-hmm. As you go along. I don't have daughters, but the culture is so fraught with misogyny and various things that, but also just, you know, the ways that boys are brought up, and it's not good for them either.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I love about Tell Me About Sex, Grandma, is that you've said grandma isn't an expert. She's not a social worker. She's not a sex educator, but she's not afraid of the questions. And I kind of saw it when I was reading it as like, grandma isn't afraid of kind of taking the time to just be in these weird kind of awkward places. Mm-hmm. And I remember I recently read Stuart Brown's book all about play. And mm-hmm. he talks about how parents have too much invested in their kids, too many fears, too many insecurities, too much of themselves kind of invested in being a parent, to slow down and be patient and have that playful space where you can just really allow the child to be who they are, which is kind of the role that grandparents end up taking in a lot of cases. If grandparents have that space that they can just let their grandkids be who they are. And I saw that so reflected in your book around like grandma is just being there and holding the space and letting these questions be while making a grilled cheese sandwich. And I'd love to know, like, for you, why was it important for it to be grandma?
Well, for exactly the reasons you say. I feel like as a parent, I'm often telling myself, okay, what would a grandparent do here? What would a grandparent do in terms of making me back off? Because I think grandparents often, when they're really in it, they know how there is some distance, just like you described. But I also wanted it to be grandma because I trusted her. I knew she's not exactly based on my grandmother or my mother as a grandmother, although there's a little bit of my mother in her. She knows this path. She knows this child. She knows there's a lot about this child that she doesn't know. And she's, you know, I wanted her to stand as the matriarch. I wanted the sexual power to be rooted in the oldest woman in the family. And that is an expression of my own longing for that to be part of our culture more and more, because mm-hmm. it's just not enough. I mean, even young women, I'm only young compared to grandma, but like, we don't trust young women with knowledge of their own bodies and power. And grandma is meant to disrupt patriarchy. I mean, patriarchy has done some very harmful things and continues to do very harmful things to sexuality and sexual liberation. It just can't happen when patriarchy is like lording over it all the time and taking away our power to define ourselves and experience pleasure, and taking away boys and every gender's right to experience exactly who they are and how they feel pleasure and how they express desire and agency in their sexual lives. I mean, I want to disrupt patriarchy. I want to undermine it. I want to be done with it.
Mm-hmm. There was a part of the book that moved me so deeply because it was something that I don't think anybody actually said to me until I was well into my late 20s. And by then, so many things had happened to me that I was not choosing for myself. And it says, it belongs to no one else but you. No one else is allowed to boss you into sex or to take it from you without your permission. You get to choose whether to do it. And the same goes for everyone. You choose for you, they choose for them. And there was just something about that that made me feel so much grief and sadness for the younger me that wishes that had been the words that people uttered to me over and over and over again throughout my childhood and teen years. You know, it's not a message you can just give one time, because everything out there, just with the way we're structured with misogyny and patriarchy and rape culture, is trying to undo that message and to teach us that's not actually the truth. And so to need that message repeatedly, and even as an adult, to hear that is so permission granting. But it was just this powerful moment for me of just this like deep sadness and grief that I didn't get those words and that message, and that I had to kind of stumble my way into it through years of harm and feeling like something was wrong and really not even understanding my own body. And to this day, still kind of like, sometimes I'm really not sure what my body's trying to tell me or what I want, because I spent so long cut off from it. Right. And I just adore that that is such a powerful, clear message. I mean, there is no excuse. There is no buffering. It is just plain as day. Like, this is the truth.
Yeah. Amen. I mean, I feel the way you feel. It took, you know, I wrote those words when I was 44 years old. It took me 44 years to come up with that line for myself, to start telling myself that. And I had heard different versions of it in my own process of recovering from the same kind of stuff that you're talking about, I expect. And I agree. It has to be repeated. It has to be, that message has to be started early and repeated. And, you know, I wanted the book to talk about rape and incest with, and I wanted to find a way to use language that wouldn't frighten children or frighten the adults who are reading with them, but would validate that those are real experiences, and they, and you already know what it is to have something taken from you without your permission. If you're a child, you 2 years old, you already know what that feels like. And you know that you dislike being bossed into things. And so if we could use that kind of language, we can help help it be different for them. It takes too long otherwise. It takes really too long. There's a lot of interference and stuff to get through, and then finally you start to feel good and you're like mid-30s or something, and that's just too long. It's just too long to wait. It's silly.
Yeah, so many of the people that I work with are trauma survivors and are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and they still aren't quite sure what sex could be, what sex means to them, how to untangle the stories that they've been told their entire lives about whether or not they deserve pleasure. And for me, to be able to be 4 or 5 or 6 years old and have a book like this that an adult reads with me over and over and over again, to really understand, like, my body is mine and I get to rejoice in that and settle into the sensations and feel confused by it, and it's all okay, and that other people have their bodies and they get to have those experiences, and it's not for me to try and change, just like they're not allowed to change mine. I mean, even if at some point you experience trauma, to have had that message the whole time, I think would completely and fundamentally change so many of the issues and the insecurities and the lifelong pain that so many of us carry, And like, I'm excited that this book exists. I'm excited that all of these books exist because, like, I mean, the thing that so many people I work with struggle with is they really don't even know how to name their wants, their needs, or to validate their feelings. And so you're doing that with these stories, but specifically around Tell Me About Sex, Grandma. I mean, like, this to me feels like healing.
Oh, that's what it's meant to feel like. And that's what I needed it to be. To the degree that I'm trying to heal myself by making these books, that's exactly the goal. And so, yes, it is written for a four-year-old who might be curious about this, but it is also for the people that you're describing in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s who are still disentangling, I don't know if that's a word, but trying to get untangled from whatever warped ways sexuality was presented to them or imposed on them or defined for them. And I wonder what adults will do with this book. I mean, it is meant to love and heal adults as well, for not to feel grief about what could have been and feel cheated, but to feel validated, as you say, about it could be so much simpler, but getting back to that once it has become complicated and once there is trauma and harm takes a lot of care and patience. We are very patient with ourselves in those processes. At our best, we're patient with ourselves, but I would like for adults to choose to look at this book. And I know adults are drawn to the divorce book and the death book. So it should be so for the sex book. I am talking to them.
I read that a question that you would love to get about this book is why there's a framed picture of Mary and the baby Jesus on the wall over Grandma's head at the very beginning of the book, when that child kind of bursts in and is like, "Hey, Grandma," and you see Grandma sitting there with that picture over her head. Why is that an important part of the story for you?
Because I wanted this story to be a little bit scary. I wanted God in the room. And we don't know how this is going to go if God is in the room. Because for many people, religion and God and any God is used to tell the child that their sexuality is bad, or that the impulse to have it is evil, or the desire for someone who is not your wife or not your husband is not, or, you know, someone who's your same sex, your same gender. There's so much hanging over our heads that is about that. And for some of us, it really penetrated and made us afraid. And I wanted that child to burst into that room and put a demand on Grandma, not ask a question, "Hey, Grandma, would you tell me about sex?" But it's a demand. "Tell me about sex, Grandma. Like, I deserve to know." And I wanted Mary and the baby there to represent the fear of God in the room. But I also then, because they're in Grandma's room and Grandma gives permission and Grandma embraces this child, their question, their curiosity, and the truth about the child's developing sexuality, which is alive already. In a way, I am also asserting that Mary as goddess, as one of the goddesses, is saying too, I approve of you as well. You're perfect as you are. When you walked into the room with your demand, I already loved you. And I want, that's another way that I want to subvert what's out there about what's a sin and what isn't. And Grandma prays to her and Grandma says it's okay. So it's okay.
Ugh, it's just like permission slip after permission slip after permission slip. I love it. You know, considering my upbringing, like, I certainly was exposed to sex. My mom was not shy about exposing me to sex as a young person. And, you know, I had Where Do Babies Come From type books from very early ages. And it was always about, you know, the mommy and the daddy hug very close. And then a baby starts growing in mommy's tummy. And I think one of the things that I just love about this book so much is, like, this book is about sex. It is not about procreation. It is not about special hugs between mommy and daddy that make babies. You know, it's a very different perspective of kind of like, sex is this whole separate thing. And like, let's actually talk about what sex is, that you get feelings and it feels good and it's about your body. And like, I love that it's not another where do babies come from book.
Yeah. No, and there's a couple of really good Where Do Babies Come From books out there now, and that, you're right, that this is not it. This is about sexuality that can happen that's not, there doesn't even need to be a partner involved. It's already, I mean, you can just nourish this, your own sexuality apart from, it doesn't say someday you will meet someone and you will decide. It's like, no, it's so much more than that. It's so much richer than that, and it's so much more your own already. So I'm glad you like that.
I do. I love it, because that's just like, I want so much more of that, right? Like, we need to create a culture where it's safe to talk about sexuality and all of its aspects. Like, I don't want to just talk about penises and vaginas and virginity. That's not interesting to me anymore. And in fact, it's harmful. So let's talk about bodies and pleasure and all the ways that that manifests. And like, this is such a wonderful starting point for those much more nuanced and diverse conversations around, you know, this child might be asexual. This child might be intersex. This child might be trans, you know, and like, there's nothing in the book that says any of those things aren't normal or acceptable. It's just this like beautiful starting point for these conversations. And like, God, we need that for adults too.
We do. And that, you know, like, every step of that was intentional. Every step. I mean, it would not be a good book if it didn't speak to and include and invite all of the people that you just mentioned. It wouldn't be worth a dollar. You know, you just can't. I knew I couldn't put something out there that excluded anyone in that way. And you know, I wanted it to be kind of a choose your own adventure book too, because I left a lot of space on the pages. There's not a lot of illustration. There's not a lot of words. And I want people to be able to personalize it when they're reading it with whoever they're reading it to. The page, like, for example, the page where the child says, "Does sex always make a baby?" Grandma says, "No, thank goodness." And the kid says, "What, you know, why, thank goodness?" Grandma says, "Oh, did I say that out loud?" So that page, there's so many different places you could go with just that. That's the place where you could talk about birth control if you want. You could talk about the fact that, you can only make a baby if the sperm meets the egg and fertilizes it. And that's only going to happen inside the woman's body. So if you're having sex with your friend and you're not engaged in that particular act, nobody's going to get pregnant. I feel like so much sex ed actually has told kids, like, as if anything you do sexually can make a baby.
Yes.
Like, no, there's so much you can do, and so many people you could do it with if you choose to. If there's no baby anywhere in that scenario, there's no chance of pregnancy. If it's the same sex relationship, there is no chance of pregnancy. And you can relax into that. Wouldn't that be something?
Oh my God, that just makes me so happy. I'm just like, more, please.
And make you happy.
I read this wonderful quote from you that, like, I think just fits in here so beautifully, since we are talking about sex and all the different ways we can have sex and all the different ways we might enjoy our bodies and relate to other people. And you said this wonderful thing that said, "Coming from a long line of passionate women, I felt drawn to the pleasures of the flesh, but more than sexual contact, I wanted the hard edges that come from having a lot of sex with many lovers. My role models were the prostitutes and old westerns who played poker with mean cowboys and won. They swore in low, husky voices, were cynical but funny, carried guns in their garter belts, and never needed men. I wanted to be scarred by love the way these women were, for
for what it's worth, I was successful in achieving my goal.
I wrote that a long, long time ago, but it sounds great coming from you.
I just think that's like such a wonderful thing to know about you, of idolizing these like sexually powerful women who were kind of like, take no shit and I don't need you, but I'll use you if I want to. And, and who embraced their pleasure and kind of knowing that for you, like that was a place of like, oh God, I want to be like them. And yeah. Yeah, I mean, that to me is just so wonderful and juicy.
Well, and what's funny is, I mean, it didn't really totally come together until I learned to fight. Mm. I mean, I was really hampered by the scars. What did I say? I wanted to be scarred by love the way they were. But then, you know, those injuries and those scars actually do kind of diminish your pleasure for a while, or at least make it really fraught and inconsistent. And then, but I had to learn to physically fight and face all my fears and all my history about rape and abuse. And then when I did, when I took these, you know, those classes that you can take with the adrenalized fighting where you, you know, you simulate real life attacks, then, oh my gosh, then it really opened up because I could trust myself. And then I really did feel like the character that that I described that you just read to me. But it wasn't until then, just because the way things being as they are, I couldn't totally relax. Couldn't totally relax until I knew that I would snap into action if the situation required it.
And I think that goes back to, I think for all kids, but specifically in patriarchy, for folks who are socialized as female, you know, we are taught that our job is to resist advances and to be wanted. And there's not a lot about our edges, about taking up space, about getting to say, no, this is my body and I do things on my terms and you can do what you want with your body. And then maybe we can decide for ourselves to do something mutually. But, you know, that is not a part of the conversation for girls. And to hear that, like, for you to find your way to that was to learn to fight, I think is really powerful. And also, you know, I think the way to change the dialogue so that we don't actually have to get to a place where we're physically fighting is for all of us to start with this foundation of autonomy and sovereignty from the youngest of ages and saying, like, your body is yours and no one else's, instead of wondering, like, is it okay to say no? Right. Am I allowed to say yes? That's a huge thing too. Right. Of like, am I even allowed to say I like these things? Because that's also really taboo.
Right. Right. And can I trust this person who I'm saying it to?
Yeah.
How will I know this person is trustworthy? Can I say to them that I want to do this with you? Are they going to tell everybody? And what's everybody going to think of me? I mean, it's really, that's another reason why sex is an ordinary, terrible thing. When those feelings start kicking in and you're just exploring a little bit with your friends or, you know, or someone who you are having a crush on or maybe even in love with in eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade, the terrain is really treacherous in terms of trust. And it's always going to be just because you just don't know. And everybody's immature. Everybody's immature. So to know your own self is really the best you can bring to that situation, at least to know your own desire and wants and how to speak about it. Or how they communicate with your body. If you can't say the words, how can you communicate with your body? That's also possible. It doesn't have to be. I mean, we know when the person that we're talking to, or holding, or involved with, feels uncomfortable. We can tell. And so, like, what if we raised children to trust their instincts about that and be like, oh, I noticed you got uncomfortable just now. Or I noticed that I'm sitting a little bit further away from you right now. You know, all of those things could be part of it. Reading our own body language, reading other people's.
Yes. And that circles back to trusting kids as the authority on themselves. And instead of overriding children's mm-hmm. wisdom and experiences of their bodies and forcing them to accept touch and forcing them to do things that they may feel, maybe feel weird about. That's mm-hmm. when we begin the indoctrination of like, well, my body says I don't really want this, or this feels creepy or icky or just unpleasant, but people are telling me I need to do it anyway. So I guess I ignore those sensations when they come up.
Right. Right. And then you take so long to unlearn ignoring them. Like what you said at the beginning of the conversation, you were like, I'm still not sure sometimes what I want. And me too. Me too. Even with people who I really, really trust, I'm not quite sure. Am I doing this to please them? Am I even here in this moment?
Yeah. So I know you've got some more books that are coming out. So tell me about Sex Grandma comes out this year. And then next year, you've got a book called Not My Idea, which is about racism. And I know that you want to talk a little bit about that. And then you've got another one coming out called I'm Not Gay. And I'd love to learn a little bit more about the two of those books because they sound amazing.
Sure, sure. The Not My Idea is about a white child coping with racism and trying to understand what is this system? What, you know, what are these images? First of all, the child is seeing, has seen the news and has seen an incident of police brutality of a white officer shooting a person who had their hands up. And that person has brown skin. And the white child is looking at this and wants to know, what is this about? And the white adults in the child's life are not forthcoming. They don't know how to talk about it. They're not prepared to talk about it. And they want to kind of just reassure the child and redirect the child. In our family, we don't see color. In our family, you're don't worry, you're safe. And it's not acceptable to the child. The child is picking up on enough to know there's something going on here. And the child does see color. And when the white adults in the child's life don't speak honestly and answer the child's questions, the child goes to the library and the child is going to get the information that they need about the injury and the history and what is has yet to be acknowledged in this country. About whiteness. I mean, really, it is a crisis of whiteness. To there, all these kids are born into it, and they didn't. It wasn't their idea, and yet they are entitled to be upset about it without defending it. They can be for justice, racial justice, and find their place in it. They don't have to just distance themselves from it and from the pain of it and, you know, from their own humanity. So that's not my idea. And I'm not gay is one that I've wanted to do for a long time. And it's about a child who is getting a lot of information from other people about who they are, being targeted for their perceived sexual orientation. And this is a child who doesn't connect to those labels yet, and may never, but is the recipient. I believe that the child is trans and doesn't know it yet. But even that, like I feel like I'm violating the child character just by saying that the child is trying to learn about themselves by all this weird attention they're getting that other people see that they can't quite see yet because they don't know what the rules are. And, you know, just so this idea of like even the child's parents say, you know, it's okay to be gay. And this kid's like, I don't even know if that's what I am. And also, it's not. I am picking up on the vibes from around. There is something out there that is hating this aspect of me, and that makes me a target. And so those are very complicated ways of describing those books. I'm sorry. I'm kind of in the weeds about it.
No, I think that those both, I mean, the thing that you said that, well, crisis of whiteness, yes. Also, getting messages from others about our identity and whether or not it's okay, yes. I mean, that is chronic as well. But what I love the most about what you said is that we can be upset without defending. And that is something that I think is so missing from some of these really big conversations around systemic oppression from the oppressors of, we can be upset and hurt and hate that this is happening and lost and not know what to do and feel overwhelmed and like we don't know where to start. And we didn't choose this and we didn't start this. Without resorting to that knee-jerk reaction of, now I'm so flooded, I'm going to either deny other people's experiences or even defend, which we see a lot, I think, around things with like rape culture and certainly conversations around race, where, you know, men give all these reasons for why a woman was raped or violated and trying to distance themselves from those terrible feelings. And the same with whiteness of the I think the pain is something that so many of us don't know how to navigate. And so I love that you're creating these books that allow kids to feel hurt and mad and angry about death and divorce and racism and gayness and all these other things that you're going to be writing about, but with it still focusing on justice. And I think that is like some powerful paradigm shifting stuff.
Let's do it.
Yes.
You know, if we can get some other people into it, we can keep going and keep talking about it. Each book should be the start of a conversation, and really just the start of seeing a child at the center of their own life, and a child with a very rich inner life. And there's a lot going on there, and we know because we remember. And to deny that is just very foolish, and it also denies us the experience of that child person who knows a lot and also is still a child. And the again and again, the demand is put on the adults. The adults need to grow up.
Yes.
and be there for the child who is still a child, and not just say, well, you know, kids are resilient. Linda Barry, one of my heroes, the cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, and teacher, she calls resilience, the resilience of kids, that whole thing, as the ability to exist in pieces. And I love her for saying that. It's in the book 100 Demons, a belief that adults have about a child's ability to exist in pieces. And, you know, if there's a spiritual belief behind each of these books and the whole series, the whole Ordinary Terrible Things series, that is about taking those pieces, and we all have a version of it. We all have the illusions that get shattered into pieces, and taking them and making a new thing that is your thing, that, you know, making a new beautiful thing that is your story, your experience of this event. Your parents' divorce is your divorce. That is yours. And so, you know, the use of collage, the use of these little slips of paper, you know, little images from magazines and catalogs and fabrics that are important to me, all of that is about taking the broken parts and putting them together into something that has wholeness and has a steadiness. And knows itself, even though it can't control anything that's going to happen next, but knows itself and is conscious. I am aware. And sometimes that's all we can bring to a moment. We can't solve everything.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that so much. And I love that creating wholeness from the broken parts doesn't mean perfection or flawlessness, or that maybe even the parts look like they fit together, right? We can be this mismatch of hurtful experiences and abuses and lovely, joyous, ecstatic experiences and stuff kind of that's in the middle we're confused about, and still find wholeness in all of those things if we're willing to kind of embrace our story and our voice, and like you said, like know ourselves for the good, the bad, and the ugly. If we can just know ourselves without trying to force ourselves to be something other, which is kind of the chronic state of adulthood these days.
Right. Or to always try to be better. I should feel better. I should be doing better. I should make other people feel better. It's just like, wait, slow down. Just see where you are. And each one is going to be different then too, with the pieces. Everyone's going to put the pieces back together in a different way. And that's really exciting that's why it's exciting to meet another person who's had many of the same experiences as you, but they're totally different. And that's thrilling.
And, you know, something that like really stands out to me as I'm thinking about everything you're talking about is I've kind of observed in the work that I do around sexuality, relationships, pleasure, and kind of body autonomy that so many of the questions I get from people who are in some type of personal or relationship crisis, what they really want is permission to not have to feel awkward, permission to not have to say the scary things. They just want someone to be able to say, here's the magic answer, so that you don't have to feel unsure or like you don't have control or like maybe you don't know what you're doing and you might make a mistake. And something that's so clear to me in these books that you're creating around the crisis of whiteness, around wondering why people are angry at folks who identify as gay, of talking about sex, of being angry at divorce, is plunging into these awkward conversations and kind of allowing that to just simply be what it is. The answers might change. You might not even have answers the first couple of times you read these books. And to just trust that if you just show up and hold that space and try, and it's the start of a conversation. I think that's something else that's really important is like, I find so many people, especially around their bodies and sexuality, want to just have a one and done because I can't tolerate needing to do this more than once because it's so scary or uncomfortable. And so I love how you said the phrase, like, this is the start of a conversation, which says we're probably going to have to talk about this lots of times in lots of different ways to even start finding our way to our answers and our truth. And I think that's like just such a wonderful thing to offer young people from the very beginning of their life in building some of these skills, right?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I like the awkward, I'm drawn to, I mean, look, your whole podcast, gives permission for all of these things to be discussed in this atmosphere of your acceptance and courage as a person to listen to those stories. And it's similar work that we do in that way of, I find the most meaning and the most education for myself in those awkward conversations. So it's natural that I would want to share that and help people do that more. It's nice when people are open to that. It's really nice when people are open to that. And I want to thank the Feminist Press specifically for taking this on and seeing these Ordinary Terrible Things books as feminist and deeply feminist, just by validating kids' lives, like that in itself. And so it would not have happened if my publisher at the Feminist Press hadn't said, oh no, this is us. This is the next thing. This is what we need to invest our energy and money in. And so they did that for me, and they did that for, you know, for anyone who appreciates these books, that That's who we get to thank.
I have to say, when I think about deeply feminist topics and change, I can't think of anything more feminist than giving young people the words to claim autonomy and sovereignty, to not expect access to others' bodies, to know that it's okay to have feelings and to articulate them regardless of your gender, that it's okay to feel happy and sad and to grieve, to ask questions about racism and sexual orientation. I mean, like, this is toppling patriarchy and misogyny and like every system of oppression that's out there that requires us to disconnect from our bodies, to right. deny our feelings, to deny the humanity in others, even if it's, you know, I mean, right. it's this to me, I agree with feminist press, is yes. like these yes. books are culture changing and culture making, because in these beautiful, subtle ways, they're just giving permission for people to recognize their own humanity.
Yes. Wow. You're terrific. I need to write down a bunch of stuff that you said. Oh, maybe I'll get a transcript from you. I like the way you tell it. I love the way you tell it back to me. I'm like, does it do that? Great.
Yay!
That is the goal.
Yes, yeah. exactly. Hopefully everybody who listened is eager to run out and grab your books or to ask their libraries to carry their books. And yeah. I would love it if you would tell everyone who joined us for this chat how they can stay in touch with you, where they can find out more mm-hmm. about your writing and these books, so that they can mm-hmm. grab them for themselves.
Sure. I keep up on my Instagram with, and I am at A Higgin Books. It's AHIGGINBOOKS. I have a website, AnastasiaHiggenbotham.com. And I'm on Facebook. And that's pretty much where I am in that world, in that cyber world. And I keep in touch and talk about, and I'll share pages as they come out of the new books. And that's been a fun thing to be able to do and have conversations with people too in those forums. That's really, I learn a lot.
Well, I will share those links as well as links to Feminist Press and your books on sexgetsreal.com for this episode so that everyone can click through and follow you and grab the books. And I want to start by saying thank you so much, Anastasia, for being here and for sharing your wisdom and your excitement and this beautiful work that you're creating.
Thank you. Thank you for appreciating it the way that you do and for helping me to find more people to share it with.
Well, I want to also thank the listeners. Please check out these books. I don't care if you have young people in your lives or not. I felt healing happening when I read these books. So wow. Please do check them out. Head to sexgetsreal.com to grab all of Anastasia's information. And of course, if you have thoughts or questions about this episode, or you have questions you'd like me to field on a future podcast, please go to the contact form on Sex Gets Real, because I love hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah on Sex Gets Real. Bye. And here we are at the end of the episode. And as promised, I have a special sneak peek into next week's episode about a book called About Abortion by Carol Singer. Some of you probably know that I have a history of being in abortion spaces. I was a clinic escort for years in Northern Virginia, protecting women and the people who came with them to the clinic from very violent and aggressive protesters. And I ran the Washington, D.C. Pro-Choice Book Club for many years. But abortion hasn't really played a big role in this show yet, in the 3 years that we've had it. And yet, that's been a gap.
We talk about reproductive rights. We talk about birth control. We talk about consent and condoms and kink. And yet abortion hasn't really played a role. And when I saw this new book about abortion from Harvard University Press, I immediately contacted them and asked to be put in touch with the author, Carol Sanger. She spent 6 years writing this book, and it is not your typical abortion book. It is a book about, it's really approachable, and it's actually kind of magical, and we talk a lot about it next week. But a big part of the book is that the stories of people who are actually experiencing abortion are largely silent and missing from the dialogue that we see around reproductive health. And so I put out a call for stories from people who have had abortions, and I received a number of responses. My guess is a lot of you will have big feelings about an episode that is about abortion. And so I wanted to share one of the stories with you to just give you an idea of how personal and approachable this conversation is going to be. It's a very, very special conversation. Carol and I actually had a phenomenal time, and you will hear more next week. But here is one of the stories. And please know, big trigger warning, there is discussion of rape, abuse, suicide, drugs. This is a heavy story, but it's an important one that moved me deeply. So Holly had her abortion when she was 17. And some of the factors that she weighed when she learned she was pregnant were her age, her health, and her future. So here's her story. I was gang raped when I was 13. I got pregnant. I was beaten almost to death 5 months later by the abusive boyfriend that had facilitated my rape. I lost the twin girls I was carrying and ended up with severe uterine trauma as a result. I turned to heroin and sex to try and forget or die, whichever was fine. At 17, I got clean and had my first real teenage relationship. I was on the pill, but still managed to get pregnant. As soon as I knew there was a baby inside me, I was ecstatic. As soon as the person I was dating knew, he dumped me. For him, it was a shackle. For me, it was a second chance to protect and nurture, something I had failed to do for my girls. I lived in southern Georgia at the time, and my father was a Marine. I drove 2 hours to be seen at a military clinic where no one knew me. Blood was drawn and an ultrasound was ordered. "Your womb is a hostile environment," said the doctor. It was covered in scar tissue and didn't have much lining. My painful and light periods were now explained. After a month in the hospital when I was 13, I had been told I would most likely never be able to have children. But being a child myself, I had thought that impossible. At 17, I realized that that one night had altered the course of my physical as well as mental future in real, lasting, immensely painful ways. The doctor said the baby had implanted too low, almost directly on top of my cervix. As it grew, it would put pressure on my cervix, which would cause it to dilate and I would miscarry. Likelihood, 95%. He could sew my cervix shut and put me on bed rest for the next 6.5 months, but there was still no guarantee I could carry to term. I was a freshman in college at the time, I was a minor, and completely dependent on 2 lovable but absent parents. I had just started my new drug-free life. The doctor recommended termination. He said he'd give me a few minutes to think about it, but something would need to be done today, regardless. I had 10 minutes to make my life or death decision. I chose to abort. I cried the entire time I was conscious. I cried every day for weeks after. I had to attend NA almost daily for months not to relapse. Since then, I have been pregnant 3 more times. All accidents, all miscarriages, and no living children. I don't know if you're looking for self-congratulations or self-admonishment here. I don't have room for either. I have anger at my abuser, at myself, at the world. But I made a choice that day, an extremely difficult one that I was fortunate to be able to have. I grieve for all my children. I still wonder at and examine all of my choices, but my life has moved forward. My current partner and I are trying to get pregnant. I am blissfully happy with him, and I'm in the best position of my life mentally and financially to have a baby. I know it could end badly again, but I'm giving it one more shot. If it works this time, I like to think that there will be a little piece of all the others in this new life. If it doesn't, then it's just a little more grief. I'm used to grief. I can handle it. So next week's episode is going to feature several different stories from people who shared their experience of abortion, their reasons, what it's meant to them since then. Some of them are happy and beautiful. Some of them are sad and filled with grief. And others are simply matter of fact. But this episode that's coming up next week, I think, is a beautiful follow-up to this week's episode with Anastasia, where we're talking about knowing our bodies, knowing our limits, and trusting ourselves. So I hope you'll stay tuned and weigh in, because it's going to be epic. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.